right in.
Darren, welcome back to Nonstop Rock Talk. It's a pleasure to have you join me on the show again. I guess it's been 8 or 9 months that you were last on. At that time, we were discussing your first solo album, Lifting the Curse, which was a stellar instrumental release. Today, we are discussing your newest release, Wonders of the Invisible World. But before we get to that, how are you doing, man?
I'm doing great. It seems like 8 or 9 months, it seems like forever, and it also seems like yesterday.
Yeah. And I believe the last time we kept cutting out.
Yeah, you're right. I remember that because I'm in the same place as I was then. I'm in the same room, and I remember that, but it seems we're having no problems right now.
Yeah, well, I think last time it was... I've actually got you tapped in on Gmail from my computer. Last time I had a different phone and I was still able to record off of it. And I think the issue was my phone. So we've gotten rid of that and we don't have to worry about that. And it looks like we're clear and we're in the clear. So we're good.
Awesome.
Yeah. So my assumption, and maybe this assumption is incorrect, possibly this album was done obviously during COVID. Would this be kind of a thing of you woodshedding and coming up with new material while we're in a pandemic?
Kind of. And I say that because it was going to get done anyway.
Right.
You know, it wasn't like I came up with the idea. That, you know, what happened after my car accident with Lifting the Curse was I wasn't really intentional. And then there came a point where it was like, okay, now it's intentional. I am going for this. This one I knew I was going to do. None of us expected a pandemic and quarantine and all that stuff. So, it definitely was a period, but I've been kind of blabbing on about this, but I may as well just mention it, where a lot of people think, hey, it's a great time to write songs and, you know, make music. But there's a certain element of, like, why? What am I even doing here? You know, what's going to happen? Can I play live? Am I going to release this? Who's going to care? You know, like, there's all these questions. And so that really messes with you artistically, I think, too. So it wasn't like I just spent all day working on it. I still had to kind of structure some time to get it finished.
Yeah. It's such a weird dynamic. It's like, in some aspects, not being able to play live for so many musicians is just more or less like cutting off your hand because, if you're an original artist and you have your creativity and you're doing your album, but in theory, doing the album means that you want to go out and play it as well and you want to be able to perform live. So it's such a, so I totally understand what you're getting at with that.
Yeah. And of course I have other projects and other bands, all going too. And plus my business, my reptile business, which I do shows for, you know, summer camps and all that. Yeah. And that all got wiped out. So it was like just a whole lot of uncertainty and basically lost a year of shows of live performance from everything. And a year in counting because who knows what's going to happen.
That's right.
But it is kind of funny because, I don't know if funny is the word, but when I did the first one, I only did one show. Yeah. And that was opening for Bisto Blanco because I was asked to do it and the album wasn't even out yet. So there were a lot of kind of cover songs mixed in and some just weird stuff.
Yeah.
But that was it. I never had time to really get a band rehearsed and to get a show together. It just didn't happen. So this time, because people kept asking me, I'm like, you know, I have this little document of checklist of things I'm going to do. And that was on the list that I was planning when this album came out to, you know, get on the road a bit. But
it's not
out of the question, but it just, not going to happen yet.
Yeah, and that's just it. And I mean, it was announced today by the government that they have purchased the vaccine, and it could be starting in the next few weeks, which I was kind of surprised about. I didn't expect anything until the new year. So, but
yeah,
it's still going to be a long time because it's not like everybody's going to be able to get the vaccine all at once. It's going to be kind of a, you know, the nursing homes and the people in the older people in facilities and the frontline workers and whatnot. And then
those who it should be really.
Exactly. But let's talk about music.
Now
tell me how you feel this material compares to the first release. What was your mindset on this one compared to the first one, actually? And I mean, in life, we pretty much go through different phases of how we feel. So to me, that is kind of a pertinent question. When you're a lyricist, it's easy to convey because it's your feelings. But as an instrumentalist, guitarist, it's what comes out from your brain to your fingers. So what was kind of your mindset on this one compared to the last one?
Yeah, that's a good question. And really, I'm also a lyricist. I mean, I've written my entire life songs, like just actual regular rock songs, pop songs, whatever. And at this point, I kind of think that's what separates me from a lot of instrumental guitar albums or guitar artists is that the songs are still structured like songs. It's kind of obvious. There's your verse, there's your chord. I mean, I do take some liberties, of course. What's different about this one, I think, is, I mean, kind of like you said, life is different.
Yeah.
And the one thing that I intentionally did different was, well, I learned a lot in the first one. I learned a lot about what I was doing with the production. I have a long way to go, but I was learning, and I'm learning just all of the ins and outs. So I kind of made a point of, for one thing, putting more guitar into it, like spending a little more time on the guitar parts, and also just trying to make everything, you know, that much better. I'll bump up the quality of everything, and I don't know. I think it worked. I think I've succeeded. At least it's not perfect, but it is better. It's, you know, there's a gradual growth there.
That's cool. Now, as I listen to it, I still hear that there's a darkness that was on the first one. Do you kind of attribute that to the fact that that is primarily how your guitar playing comes out?
Yeah, I think so. I think, it's just kind of the way I write. I think there's some, you know, fun, quirky things going on.
Yeah.
But a lot of it does still kind of lean back. There's one song, because I'm working on a video. Actually, I was working on that on the weekend, and I was watching the footage and everything, and I'm like, I'm going to be one of those people and I'm scrapping everything and starting over.
Oh boy.
I'm like, no, this sucks. But, you know, that's how it goes. But the song, I was relearning it because whenever you do a video, you think, oh, I know it, and then I better relearn it. So what I noticed was that I was writing it from the perspective of a major key, but it kind of came across in the like relative minor.
Yeah.
And so it sounds like one of the darkest sounding things on the album.
Yeah.
So it's funny how that is. Yeah.
That is funny. Now, in terms of musicianship, on the last one, it was primarily you and drummer Emily Dolan. Did you follow that same path on this one, or was this primarily everything is you on this one?
Yeah, every single thing. There was no additional players, samples, anything. Everything that's on this is entirely me. So if you like it, great. If you don't, it's all my fault. It's all done by me. The only place where it finally changes is when I get mastered, and that's my advice to anybody who's putting out their own or any album is to don't skimp on the mastering. Get somebody a good good company or somebody who really knows what they're doing. It makes a huge difference.
Yeah, it makes a big difference. You're totally right. I agree with that. Let's talk about the first track on the album and the title track, Wonders of the Invisible World. What was your thinking behind that title, and how did it coincide with the actual song? I mean, you obviously, and we did touch on this before, but you must listen to it and all of a sudden the title comes to you. It's just such a cool
thing. Sometimes that happens. Other times, you know, it's kind of like in my phone, this is the thing about digital stuff, right? In my phone, I have samples. Even today, I was doing it. I'm like, oh, I got to press play on my little voice recorder and record a little guitar part because I'm like, yeah, this is kind of cool, a chord or melody or whatever. I do the same thing with lyrics. And also with song titles, I'm always in my notes. If I come up with little ideas, I put them in there. That's kind of neat. And sometimes that'll come back to me. I'm like, oh, this is a perfect title for this song. Wonders of the Invisible World, that one, the title, I totally lifted that from, I'm drawing a blank, Cotton Mather, I think is the name. Geez, I don't know why it's just giving me a blank there, but based on the Salem Witch Trials, he put it out, I think it was 1693.
Oh, wow.
And to me, it was like, this is what you get from working in a library, right?
Yeah.
But it was very much like an excuse for, you know, all the atrocities that happened. Like it was not taking ownership of what they did. It was making excuses for, hanging a bunch of people that were innocent. And so I thought, well, it's kind of neat because the title, I can put a positive on it. And then also the fact, like, Wonders of the Invisible World, well, music is invisible when you think about it. It's in the air. I mean, unless you're reading sheet music, which, no judgment if that's what you want to do for fun. But, I mean, just yeah. Music in general, it's in your ears, it's in your head. So it's invisible, and to me, it's a magical thing. It can, inspire so many emotions and... So that's where the title came from. Kind of a long explanation, but
no, that's good. That's perfect. It's funny because you don't really put that into context of. And it astounds me. And I said this before: is just trying to come up with a title for a piece of music that doesn't have lyrics to it and doesn't have a chorus. You know what I mean?
And it's funny because you could put anything. You could say anything. Yeah.
You could, but I think sometimes just in a title, it creates a vibe or a mood as well. So coming up with the right title, I think, is very important. Like, just imagine if, like, Joe Satriani, for instance, Surfing with the Alien, and the cover kind of coincides with that album as well, and there's Surfer Dude. But I couldn't imagine it being called anything else than Surfing with the Alien.
Yeah, and of course, because that's what we know, right? Imagine, maybe if it was called something else, we couldn't imagine it being called
Surfing with the Alien. That's such a weird concept, right? could talk about it forever, but it is, to me, it's like I couldn't imagine that being, or Satch Boogie, for instance, it's good.
Which, of course, it has that a swing, so Satch Boogie makes sense, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's just, to me, it's just a very cool type of thing. Now, I love the title, Night of the Neurotoxin.
Oh, Neurotoxin.
Now, that's a title. Because I hear a very Sabotage type of groove in spots. I'm a huge fan of Sabotage's Handful of Rain album. It kind of shows the direction of that band was going in terms of what became Trans-Siberian Orchestra. But then, but on that song, you also go with this like country type of vibe in spots of this like type of picking that you're doing. And that's very interesting.
It's just this dramatic, change and shift in places where it's like, what is happening? Well, the title, that's actually, I kind of think it's funny. I was out for a walk one evening and got stung by a damn wasp. And
really?
and all I could think was how interesting it was that, like, the second I got stung, which was, like, around the ankle, that I felt like I was getting a migraine or something. Like, it just right in between the eyes. And I thought, wow, that's a neurotoxin going through your veins like lightning speed from this little bug.
Yeah.
And then I'm walking home thinking, yeah, that's what I'm going to call this, Night of the Neurotoxin. And because I was working on that song, like I was kind of taking a break and going for a walk. And Funny enough, when I was packing up, I was in the garage, I'm loading stuff into the car to go do shoot the video for Wonders of the Invisible World. I got stung on the finger by a wasp.
Oh my
God. I'm like, what is going on?
Yeah. Well, it's funny because that may be the only time you ever want to get stung by a wasp, because it inspired you to come up with the title.
Right? Yeah, that worked. It was like just a horror movie title or something, you know?
Yeah, no, but there's an actual story behind it, and that's cool. What I find interesting about your playing is how you change it up. It isn't the same thing throughout, which I think is very important when you're creating instrumental music. Now, that process for you, and also laying it down, I mean, you obviously have the initial idea, but I'm just curious how you kind of make it all mesh together. Like, it's got to be going through your head of, it's easy, again, when you're doing chorus, bridge, you know, verse, etc., but doing an instrumental thing has to be a little bit more thought put into that for you.
Well, yeah, I think there's obviously a lot of attention to detail, and I say this not I'm not complaining. It's just a fact when you're doing everything yourself and you're producing it, and you're mixing it, and you're like every detail. It takes a lot more time,
right?
And so that's one of the reasons why, you know, I can't put one of these out every, you know, 5 months or something, or every 2 weeks like Spotify would like, you know. Just, you can't can't do that. You have to put the time and effort into it, and like I said, details, because not only like if I played the exact same, you know, melody, cut and paste, you know, for this verse and that verse and everything, it would get pretty stale pretty fast. So there are subtle differences where the bass does something different, or keys start coming in, or I add a harmony or something. You know, you have to kind of wear the producer hat, I guess, when it comes to that, to make it pop in certain places. Dynamics, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and I found that in the material, because it's not, sometimes, you know, some instrumental music, you'll get the same thing, but not very often. It's like, it's a progression of the song. It's like, there's a build, and there's, you know, and then there's other, it's like hills and valleys kind of type of thing. And,
yeah.
You know, it's such a cool, thing. And I mean, for you, when recording, do you find that you're redoing things? You're like, okay, I played this part, I don't know if I like that, let's do that again, let's kind of change that.
Yeah.
So you're probably your own worst critic, right? Because you're like, okay, is that a major process in doing this kind of thing?
It is, for sure. I mean, there are some parts which are, you know, kind of ad-libbed, and it's like, okay, that's what I wanted to capture, and I'm going to leave it. But a lot of it is, you know, okay, that's pretty good, now I need to work on it and refine it and make it better. Most of the time, as a guitar player, you probably appreciate this, but when I'm writing solos for any song or lead parts, I find I will immediately use way too many notes. You know, where you're just shredding and then go, what was I thinking? And then it's like, all right, I'm going to knock 30 or 40% of those notes out, and, you know, make every note count. And it just makes everything so much better for the listener.
Yeah.
Because sometimes it's just, you know, sometimes it's just nonsense. It's like, why am I doing this? And I don't mind if, you know, the shredder label, but it's not really accurate for what I do. I mean, even somebody like Steve Vai, and I'm not comparing myself to Steve Vai, just to put that out there, but somebody like him, where people will call him a shredder, but yeah, he isn't really, I don't think that's what he does, you know?
I don't think
he's capable.
He's very, no, I mean, he makes it interesting.
Yeah, but he's a composer, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree with you. And it was funny because in the last few weeks, he's made comments about Eddie Van Halen and saying, I will never be Eddie Van Halen or even close to what Eddie Van Halen was, which I think is a huge compliment coming from Steve Vai.
Sure. Like, yeah, yeah.
You know, like, wow, that says a lot because Steve Vai's like, you know, like for guys like us growing up with Steve Vai.
Like, yeah, he's God, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's like Eddie Van Halen's God, but so is Steve Vai. I mean, they're, you know,
I look at it like there are the gods, right? And,
yeah.
And when I think, I mean, Eddie is somebody that, I mean, you just don't hear, whether even before his passing, you just didn't hear any great guitar players dissing Eddie. You know, nobody, because he just, you know, he was a lot more than Eruption, as great as that was. And he could have ridden his entire career on that. He could have just said, all right, there we go, Eruption, that did it. But he didn't.
No.
Not even close, right?
No, and he kept going and pushing. Like, for those first, five, six Van Halen albums, he was kind of pushing the envelope. He kept, you know, like, when you think of On Fair Warning, Mean Street, and you think of, like, Cathedral.
Oh, the beginning of Mean Street, like, the hell, right?
Yeah, exactly. You're, like, this two-finger harmonic tapping, and it's like, oh, my God. And just hearing that I remember being a kid hearing that for the first time, and I didn't get it. I didn't even know what it was until.
Yeah, and it's so musical, too. Like, it was so, you know, rhythmic and musical, and. But, I mean, when you think about, you know, some of these, some of the players today that, you know, like Steve Lukather and Phil X and some of these guys that are just, you know, insanely good, and they all, you know, have nothing but love for Eddie. So,
yeah.
I mean, that says something, right?
It says a lot, and it's funny because, you know, before Eddie passed away, it was kind of like, it wasn't on the forefront because no one was talking about it. And then all of a sudden, Eddie passes away and it's like this huge musical. So many people are just like, I can't believe he's gone. And this is unbelievable. It's hard to, it's still, for me, it's still hard to believe because.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That was a painful one. I have to admit, that was hard.
I agree.
You know, people were posting stuff like immediately on social media, and it took me a day before I could post anything because I was just, you know, it's one of those things where everybody processes these things differently, I guess. And I find I'm a hypersensitive person.
Yeah.
And when the same thing like when Prince died, and when somebody, people will say, yeah, I'm going to go listen to Purple Rain tonight. And I'm like, man, I can't listen to that for a couple of months now. Like, I just,
Yeah, I was the same. I mean, I couldn't listen to any Van Halen because it was too weird. And even today, I find it too weird. It's like, what do you mean Eddie Van Halen's not on this earth anymore?
Yeah.
You know, that just seems so weird to me.
Yeah, because it's not like he's old. But then a lot of people that we lost, you know, were not really old. You know, Prince wasn't old.
No.
These guys should have been around for a lot longer. And I have to say, I really like the Wolfgang single that he put out.
Yeah,
I like the song. I mean, it's not just like I watched the video and I was like, oh my God. Like,
that was hard to watch.
But aside from the video, the song and his singing, the whole thing, and he's, you know, he did it all himself. And it's, he's the real deal, I think. He's got the Van Halen gene, you know.
He does, and I mean, he's going to carry on that legacy, which is amazing. But he's going to carry on that legacy as Wolfgang Van Halen because he doesn't. There's the elements aren't really doesn't really sound like Van Halen. It's him. It's
right.
You know. It's and it shows that talent and, like you said, that gene that he has gotten. But it's totally different.
And it should be him, right? It should be like he said. Why would he do Van Halen covers when he goes out and starts playing? That's not, I mean, he was in the band, to be fair, but still, you know, and Alex, imagine what that must be like, because he's always played with his brother. And
I mean,
and often, amazingly, doesn't get enough credit for what a killer
drummer.
You know, the whole band and
the whole band. Yeah.
You know, right? And I'll make this, since we're talking about Van Halen, I'll make this statement too, and not everybody will agree with me, but you know, I love Sammy Hagar, but and I say but because. Yeah. It's not that I love Dave more than Sammy. It's not a one or the other. It's the fact that I find people always just, there's this kind of mythology around Sammy being the singer and Dave being the showman. But yeah. If you go back and listen to those albums, man, like, he was a great singer. I mean, he had to be. Like, you couldn't have Michael Anthony singing those harmonies if he couldn't sing. You know? Right. Like, he was a great singer, great, you know, they had a lot of hit songs, and that wasn't because of Eddie, you know, it was a great
Dave band. Had that charisma and that front man. You know, I've been thinking a lot about this lately. There's always that Sammy Hagar, David Lee Roth debate. But for me, if Van Halen had never come out with that lineup with David Lee Roth, we would have never gotten the Sammy Hagar lineup.
So, no, and he's acknowledged that too, right? He's, like, even Sammy has said that. You have to respect what was done before. And
yeah, I think with the Sammy stuff, it was more, I think, a little bit more commercial. There was more, you know, more hits. But the David Lee Roth stuff is so cool too.
It was so raw. And
yeah. And
I mean, when I listen to Women and Children First, it's like, it's just a reckless abandon, you know, it's like, it's just crazy.
You know, and I mean, let's Sammy Hagar would never say, I love the way the line runs up the back of the stocking.
Like, yeah.
You know what I mean? That's just cool. It's just like, it, you know, Dave's banter and it's Dave Lee Roth, because Sammy wouldn't say that. Sammy would be more like, hello, baby, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah,
that's more
which
Sammy.
Which is cool, too. It's his thing, you know.
Yeah, it's just...
But it would have been a different band.
That's right. It's just...
Well, it was, you know, when I listened to... I don't remember what Van Hagar, for lack of a better... I don't remember which album it is, but I popped one on in the car the other day, and I was listening, and I was like, that was really good, but it is a different band.
Yeah.
It's a different, I mean, obviously it's only a different singer, but the style is just very different.
Yeah.
And,
totally,
you know, obviously successful, and I still enjoy it. It's just not the same. It's a different, which is cool because, you know, I'm not, maybe because I am a musician, but when an artist grows in a direction, even if I'm not really digging it, I have to give them that respect that, you know, why should they not? Why should they be stagnant for me?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, it's funny. Talking of Van Halen, like the Gary Cherone stuff, I think a lot of people are not big fans of.
He's never mentioned when people talk about Van Halen
thing. He's not even. He's not even no one ever talks about it. I mean, that was a dark album. It was different. Apparently the one that they were working on for after that was a little bit more a little bit more Sammy Hagar Van Halen. And hopefully one day we might get to hear some of that stuff, which I think would be cool.
That would be. I felt that album, one of the things that just, and I don't know why, I don't know what the problem was, but because Gary, I mean, he's a great singer.
Yes.
Great writer, great frontman. He's a very entertaining guy. It's not like he's new at the game. You know, he's had some experience. So,
yeah.
But yet, it seemed like all of the songs he was singing at the top of his range, like, I'm going to sing higher than Sammy. And I don't think it was his fault. He was probably, you know, here's the key of the song. Yeah, here's how we want you to sing it. I wasn't there. I don't know. But it just seems so odd that it's so grating to listen to because he's way up there high singing, and it's just like, I think it would have been a better album if they you know, tuned it down a little, like had him sing a bit lower sometimes.
It's very funny because you look at Gary Cherone and Van Halen, but then you look at Gary Cherone on Pornograffiti, on Extreme's Pornograffiti, or the first Extreme album, and even the next two. But I mean, Pornograffiti is probably the one that people enjoy the most, maybe.
Probably the most well known, anyway.
Most well known, yeah. And I mean, the songwriting on Three Sides to Every Story, there was some really brilliant stuff on it.
It was fantastic, yeah.
Exactly. It was very fantastic. It's just Pornograffiti was kind of the one that kind of put them on the map, right? And
of course, yeah.
It was popular. Yeah. And it's funny because when he joined Van Halen, I was so excited because I'm like, oh man, if this is going to be like Pornograffiti, which was, you know, my favorite Extreme album, then this is going to be, I think this is just a match made in heaven. And then it was just, and I saw the tour and I saw him with Van Halen.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And he was great. And I will say that.
Yeah. I saw some of the live footage and I was like, yeah, that was a different. That was totally different than what the album was.
Yeah.
You know, like he'd fit, I thought, but he fit with the band.
Yeah, and you know what? He's a super talented guy. And I also think back to the Freddie Mercury concert when Extreme played it, and I thought out of everybody that played that day, I thought they were one of the best, like doing all that Queen stuff, and it was unbelievable. And I thought Gary Cherone, like, so when he joined the band, I thought, okay, this is perfect, the perfect guy to replace Sammy Hagar to have that next step. It's such a weird thing. And I think maybe the album wasn't as good as it could have been, but I think the fans also couldn't accept another Van Halen singer either.
Yeah, how many times can you manage that level of success, right? We did it once, we'll get another singer.
I mean, they should have taken a cue out of the Black Sabbath book where, you know, like Ozzy and then Ronnie James Dio, and then you've got Gillan, and getting Gillan in was a complete bust, right? So,
yeah.
So it's kind of weird.
You know, really, that's, in a lot of times, even in that case, it's not necessarily that they're not bad singers, they're maybe even not the wrong person. They just, whatever reason, fans are not going to be on board with it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, look what happened with Motley Crue, right? When they got Krabi, even myself, I mean, now it's one of my favorite Motley albums, but when it came out, I was like, it's a little bit weird, but Vince had Exposed out, which was like more Motley than Motley. You know?
It was an amazing album.
Playing on it.
It was
if you liked, you know, the glam metal of the day, then that was perfect.
Yeah.
And then Vince was singing well. And
like, I was a fan of the Scream, so, I will rephrase that. I actually bought the Scream when I found out that John Corabi was the new singer of Motley Crue. So I was like, I want to hear this guy, hear what,
gotcha, to expect, yeah,
what to expect. I loved Exposed, and I will say that I still love Exposed. I think in terms of Vince coming out, I understand he had a bit of help on it, but I think he did a great job, and it was, like you said, it was Motley Crue part two. It was singer Motley Crue as he should sound. But the Motley Crue self-titled, I remember the first time I heard of the debut of Hooligan's Holiday on the radio. And I was actually one of the people, I was like, I love this. I just think this is amazing, right? Maybe it was because I knew what to expect with John Corabi because I had already heard his previous material, I don't know. But I was really excited about it, and I was very disappointed because after buying the album and hearing how great it was, I was disappointed at the fact that people just didn't buy into it. It was a very strange thing.
Well, because it's so different, right? It was so different than what... And it took a long time. It took a long time to get out, and it's, you know, and you figure it was a bit ahead of its time, you know, sonically and everything. And at that point, a lot of the people who were Motley fans, you know, with everything kind of switched over, where they still wanted something, I think, that was like Exposed or like Motley. They didn't want something too 90s sounding.
Yeah.
But, you know, and that's one of the things, like you said, about Vince getting some help doing Exposed. And a lot of times that's the case with solo albums. And I think that's why, like, on my solo album, I was saying, like, you know what, it's a true solo album. So it's everything is done by me. And I quoted Belinda Carlisle. Not that I'm trying to throw anybody under the bus here, but, you know, there's somebody who had a huge, successful career outside the Go-Go's.
Yeah.
And I love the Go-Go's. I think, like, great songs and just the perfect element of all the musicians in their original form. And they're still great. But when Belinda went and did her solo stuff, I thought, okay, well, it's going to be a representation of who she is. But really, it was, you know, a team of, you know, songwriters and producers and, you know, so I was kind of disappointed to go, wow, I'm reading the credits and she didn't do anything other than, you know, show up and sing, and which is not a bad thing. It's still her singing, but, you know, I didn't like the direction as much. It was too poppy for me. But anyway, I guess my point is that she didn't, like, it's not how much of a solo album this is.
Yeah. What was the, Heaven is a Place on Earth, is that one of her?
That was one of the big hits, yeah.
That was one of the big hits. I was just trying to think, I was like, what was that big hit? And I do remember that. And she, I mean, yeah, so they kind of, it was kind of a situation where they were kind of molding and making her into a pop star, I guess you could say, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Which is unfortunate. You know,
yeah, I mean, it's the good news, I guess, is that if you liked the original band, that they're still doing stuff, and
yeah,
you know, they've gone through all kinds of lineup changes throughout the year, but it actually is. They have a documentary out, but I didn't see it. It just it came out like recently. I don't remember where it is, but they did, like, where to find it, but it is out.
I'll have to look that up. That's cool. I'd like to watch that. I mean, I'm always usually anything to do with a rock band or, you know, I usually try and watch it because it's always interesting. I would like to hear people's stories and a band's story. It kind of fascinates me.
Yeah, even if they're different. Like, if you read, I was reading Kathy Valentine from the Go-Go's, her blog, and Belinda Carlisle's book, which came out, like, quite a while back. But she even says, Kathy even says, like, my story of the same thing may be different than somebody else's because we're different perspectives and memories and stuff. And which is kind of fun.
So, yeah, it is fun. I agree. Now we kind of went off on a tangent there, but that's good. That's why it's rock. So
exactly.
Let's talk about Ghost Notes. Has an eerie vibe, but could be taken in two ways, kind of like an oxymoron, so to speak. First, of course, it's the vibe, the ghost, you know, spirits, whatever. And secondly, could also be termed in music terms of notes, you know, like ghost notes kind of thing.
Yeah.
Kind of give me your thoughts on that, on this song.
Well, you're exactly right with the title, of course. It's the word. It's almost like a concept. Same about the last album. Even though there are no lyrics, the whole thing, the artwork, the sound, everything, it could be a concept album.
Yeah.
That song is just, you know, I was even toying with whether or not I wanted to put it on there because it is so weird.
Yeah.
And it's weird. It's different than the others. I wouldn't call it industrial, but there are a few bizarre thing is going on there.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, I don't know, I kind of just had this feeling I liked the way it, I liked the feeling of it, the atmosphere, and I thought, man, it's kind of cool. I'm just gonna, you know, fix it up and put it on there. So, yeah, but surprisingly, it took a lot of work to make it acceptable to me.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I mean, like we said before, sometimes you hear something in your head and then you kind of hear it in your head, but then when you go to do it, it's like, oh, that's not what I wanted. Okay, let's start again, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Now Ice Storm, and I have to say the Saturday Night Live reference, I've got a fever and the only cure is more cowbell.
Yeah, it's because there is cowbell on that one.
That's right.
I think there's cowbell on a couple ones.
Yeah, and which is great because you're using cowbell. Now, why Ice Storm? Was this written during a storm possibly? I mean, we live in Canada, so an ice storm in the winter is always possible.
Well, it was kind of, I had already started writing it, and there's a part where it seems like a Rush thing, to tell you the truth, if I had to pick a band.
Yeah.
There's a part where it just cuts off the chorus right in an awkward place, and like next thing you know, you're on a mountaintop, and it's like, it's got that, and I just, that's what it felt like was a storm. And I don't know about where you are, but here in 98, we still talk about this here, the great ice storm, because a lot of us barely survived it. I mean, when I lost power for 8 days, and this is January, so it was just, you know, and I had like 300 reptiles, and I was nightmare. Yeah, so that sticks in a lot of our minds here. And then as I was doing this, that's why I called it that. And I kept thinking of how funny it was, how living through that ice storm, and we talk about it like that was 20 years ago or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And then the fact that now we're living through this pandemic, and we'd be like, I wouldn't have believed that 20 years ago. I would have been,
That's never going to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where that whole thing came from.
That's cool. Now, Slithering, that's another one that's interesting to me because as the listener, I mean, you can imagine, you know, a snake, but then the reptile, the snake, or you can also personify it as a snake who's a person. Slithering and snake is always an open-ended question because they're good and bad people. I mean, there's those that can hide their true personality very well, and in the end, true colors show. So, I mean, the term Slithering, that kind of speaks to me, even in an instrumental song, because that almost paints a vision of what you're listening to. How did you kind of perceive that?
Well, that's interesting, because I had that title written down, like, probably for, I don't know, 4 years, and I did have, I don't remember even which part, but there was a little bit of it that was already written and assigned to that title.
Yeah.
And then finally I just kind of expanded on it and probably changed it entirely. But as far as the origins, I kind of felt like it was, I mean, as somebody who is a snake lover, it's kind of, I guess, you know, putting the, putting the comparison to something bad with them is tough. But I did think of that sneakiness, and the riff, the main riff kind of has a sneaky sliding around sort of thing going on, and I'm like, that works.
Yeah, and that's funny. I mean, so it's, I think you did a really good job of naming the songs, of like,
thank you.
Perception, which I think is really cool, because sometimes, you know, I've got instrumental albums and I don't know what half the names of them are, like the songs are. I'll listen to them and think, oh, that's a cool song, but I don't use it. Sometimes I don't pay attention to what the title is. To actually, I think possibly with doing the podcast, I have to focus on that a little bit more because we're going to talk about it. And
right,
but which I think is cool. So I think maybe I should go back and listen to some of these albums and actually look at the titles and maybe get a little bit more of a perception of what that artist was going for.
Well, and it's different nowadays too, because you know, it could be, if I'm driving and listening to CDs, and that's usually when I listen to music, and it, my thing, my display doesn't give me the titles of the songs.
Yeah.
So a lot of times, I'm not sure if it's instrumental, you're really screwed, because it's like, there's no chorus, no, you can't even guess at it, right?
No.
And I have lots of people tell me that they like listening to this album while they're, you know, working out, or somebody from university messaged me the other day saying that she listens to it when she's studying all the time. That's really cool.
That's very cool.
But, you know, that's one of the things with instrumental music. You can kind of zone out and still enjoy it.
Yeah.
the lyrics aren't taking you out of something. It's just you can listen to it. But of course, then you don't always know what the song titles are.
Yeah, it's funny that we mentioned that about the CD player, because like it's like you think of when CD players first came out and when the CD, like, we saw a number. What track?
Yeah.
So you'd have to look at the back of the CD, see what it was. Now, with the way technology is, where it advanced, it's like, oh, I can see what the name of the song is now. It's indexed. And then with the whole newer vehicles, you've got the thing off your phone and it shows you the album cover and everything.
Yeah.
It's pretty wild how that evolution has gone along. And then you forget about it. Then you forget that that's the way it used to be, right?
Yeah, and soon they're going to be like, you know, advertising things to you while you're driving, you know, like interrupting the CD or the music. It's not even a CD anymore. You don't have a player.
I hope that never happens.
it's when I think about music and musicians and kind of the undervaluing, and I don't want to sound like I'm somebody bitching or anything, it's just a point that kind of sticks with me sometimes, is how when we think of something like Spotify, and I shouldn't even name them by name, I'm not attacking Spotify, it's just the fact that streaming services and that it's criminally low, the percentage that we get as content providers for billion-dollar companies, and we almost do it to ourselves, you know, the musicians make these videos making it look like they're billionaires and they've got this fancy car and all this, you know, the car's rented, who gets paid at the end of the day? Well, the dancing girls get paid, they should, they're professional, they're there doing their job. The person who owns the house gets paid, the guy who owns the car, well, again, that's rented. The musicians are the ones in debt, and they go back to their job serving, you know, coffee or whatever. Totally respectable, but I think a lot of people don't see that. Yeah. And all this griping, all of this, I'm coming to a point, and that is, when you think about movies, right, you think of the film industry, if you go and buy a DVD, so you purchased it, that's your property, you go home, you put that DVD in to watch a movie, and every single time, you have to sit through an FBI warning, you have to sit through their advertisement of their company that on something you bought. It's like, this is mine. And where that gets to me is, like, can you imagine doing that on a CD? Like, musicians, people wouldn't accept that.
Like, no, they would not be happy about that. But maybe they should have started that to begin with. You know?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure they should have. I get annoyed because I still feel like this is my property. I bought it. Why do I have to sit through your advertisement?
Yeah,
you know?
Got it. It's
so... Yeah, it's not, I'm not saying they should do it. I'm just saying, look at the difference of the respect and the way that people view the film industry versus music. But you have people like Gene Simmons, with all due respect, who says, oh, it's the fans who are greedy and they killed rock. But it's not. It's the labels underpaid the artist, overcharged the fans for CDs when they knew that they didn't cost anywhere near as much as what the hike was. And people are not that stupid, right? They go, come on. So now they think, well, the bands are millionaires. We're just going to steal this. Or we're going to... And now they don't even have to. Now it's just free. You can just go on streaming services.
Yeah, music doesn't mean anything to people. To a lot of people, it doesn't mean anything. I can just take that. It's mine. I'm going to take it.
Yeah.
It's like, well...
And you know what? I'm happy if people want to stream my music because... Yeah. At least there's something. I get it. Yeah, and it does help, and I'm appreciative if anybody does. You know, that doesn't cost them anything and still makes me happy. But it's just the mentality of, musicians being basically worthless.
Well, I mean, I've been thinking about this too, and I think about playing, you know, doing the tribute thing I was doing years ago. And thinking, here we are 15 years later from when I started, and the money hasn't gotten any different.
No.
You know what I mean? Like, it's still...
No, there's no inflation on the payout.
No, there's no inflation on payout. It's It's like it's the same as it was 15 years ago, but the prices of beer have gone up in a bar, you know, like all their prices have gone up. So, I mean, where are they going to try and skimp? I guess the band will be the first place they're going to do that, right? Which is unfortunate.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, I've played a lot of shows, like what I was saying before about the video, you know, everybody gets paid first.
Yeah.
And then the band is on the hook for it. Well, I've done a lot of shows where, I mean, it's cost me money to play, even though the place was packed and, you know, the people at the coat check got paid, the bartender got paid, the sound guy got paid, everybody got paid, and they should.
Yeah.
But the band is the last one to get paid. Why are all of those people there drinking? Because the band's there. So
I know,
they all bought a ticket, they all came, and then the band, you know, in order to make that show a success, we did all the promotion and gave away free merchandise to get people there, and then, you know, and then you basically are out of pocket. And I know it's a weird complaint, especially since we're not playing shows now anyway.
No,
but
no, that's true. I mean, once we get back to playing shows, I mean, we'll all be happy, but...
I think you're right. I think even everybody will be happy.
I think so. But it's, I mean, I think it's a good gripe. It's like, okay, you know, like maybe someone will listen to this and they'll go, you know what? Okay. That makes sense to me. I don't think people realize the amount of work that you put in going to a show, getting to a show, doing, you know what I mean? Like, it's not just show up on stage for an hour or 2 hours, whatever you're doing.
And none of us are doing it for the money, because we were, we would have stopped a long time ago.
That's right.
Exactly. You know, you can make more money doing anything, you know.
It's for the love of getting to play and, you know, people enjoying what you're doing, right?
Of course, yeah.
It's just such a bizarre, it's a bizarre thing.
Well, you know how many times I've read articles online and watched YouTube videos of people who are, you know, what's the word here? Like, I don't want to say gurus, but, you know, that are helping people with their path on their musical journey.
Yeah.
And people always say, well, treat it like a business. You know, you want this to be a business. You have to treat it like a business and invest in yourself. And usually the people who say invest in yourself or they have something to sell.
Yeah.
Which is fine. But I guess my point is that I have been in business for over 2 decades for myself, and I've never seen a business that operates like the music business. You know, it's not like, here's my price, pay my, you know, it doesn't,
it
doesn't work.
It's funny because there's everybody wants their hand in the business, I guess you could say. I mean, when you become a big band, if you ever look at one of those pie charts of what, you know, what the band actually gets and what everybody else gets, it's crazy. It's nuts. So.
Yeah, and they're the first ones to get dropped if things, you know, aren't going so well. They're, it's like, well, this band has outlived its purpose. Like,
and I mean, that's not an uncommon thing, because I think every band, so many bands have outlived their, you know, their genre or whatever it is, right? You were cool 4 years ago. Now you're not cool anymore, which is such a weird thing.
And imagine, you know, as an artist, you never think that. I mean, you might logically think, okay, well, this could go bad at any time. Of course, you know that you should have that on your head. But, you know, you're riding a wave and everything is going great. Well, why wouldn't it continue? I mean, the Rolling Stones are still going, right? I mean, you know, but no, so I'm sure nobody really thinks that they are, you know, dispensable, but show business.
And that's just it. And the funny part about that too, of that whole statement, is you take a band and say a band has, you know, let's go back to the late 80s, early 90s. Okay. There were bands that had certain, you know, like Poison had a makeup image and it was the glam thing. But then you had other bands, like say a band like Tesla, who had, you know, like, they're like, okay, we're going to have a little bit more integrity. We're not going to wear makeup. We're going to look like, we're going to be classed as a working man's band. Well, in the end, it didn't help them either, because they got lumped into being with Poison anyways, right?
Yeah, well, I saw them twice opening for once was with Poison and once was another band that was similar. I don't remember who it was, but yeah, they were still in that. Yeah. And now all these years later, people still categorize the weirdest things
with
hair metal or whatever.
Hair metal, hair band, you know, whatever you want to call it. It's just, I mean, can it just be, I mean, why does there have to be a category? Can it just be a rock band, hard rock band, or whatever you want to call it? It's just a band.
Yeah, I always look at it that way, too. I find it's almost like a hobbyist thing, you know? We have to subcategorize and subgenre and micro-genre everything. And to me, it sounds like somebody collecting, you know, Star Trek cards or something. Like, it's just all of these. Because some people are so into it, they will know exactly what everything is.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I can't imagine myself arguing with somebody over whether or not, you know, Motley Crue is metal or not. Like, who cares?
Exactly. Well, I mean, I had a conversation with someone the other day. It was about Metallica, and I can't remember what band it was that opened for them. It might have been Queensryche. But they got booed.
Yeah, I saw them.
They got booed off the stage.
I saw that tour, yeah.
Yeah, they got booed off the stage because, you know, it's Queensryche and, you know, the Metallica fans are like, this isn't Metallica, you know what I mean? Like, it's...
Yeah.
But
it didn't matter who it was, they were... Yeah,
yeah, and I mean, why would you boo Queensryche? They are like, you know, like, that's a pretty serious band, a very intellectual band, so to speak, you know what I mean?
Well, they're insanely talented, and they were, I think they were just a little more metal before that.
Yeah.
That was the Injustice for All tour, if I remember correctly.
It was.
And, and when I saw them, they weren't booed, but they certainly weren't given a great welcome, you know? Yeah. I mean, maybe somebody was booing, but I don't know why would somebody, I don't get that.
Yeah, I don't get that either. It's just, it's such a bizarre thing, and... I think that was a tour where Scott Rockenfeld, the drummer, had the his cymbal stands were chains or something. I don't know if you recall that. It was really cool. It looked really cool, though.
Yeah, I do remember that. Yeah,
it was cool. And for me, I wish I had seen that tour because I would have loved to see those two bands together. Even though they may not have fit together, I still would have loved to see them both. And to see Queensryche with the five original guys... in that incarnation would have been cool too.
And it was great, and it's funny that you say that because I often think what bands, you know, may go together. In your mind, you go, oh, man, I'd love to see these bands together, but the masses don't necessarily accept it.
Yeah,
and I'm also doing a lot of interviews. I get asked that quite a bit, like, who would I like to go out on tour with, and it's like, well, since we're talking about my instrumental project, I'm sort of thinking of that, and I'm like, man, I have no clue. I couldn't, you know, I have clues. I have who I would like, but that doesn't mean that it's a good fit.
Yeah.
You know, what your heart wants doesn't make any always business sense. And I remember a quote, it was Wednesday 13, saying that the first time he got, it was 2001, something like that. He got his tour with Alice Cooper.
Well,
and he thought, he was like, this is going to be great because he, like me, is such a huge Alice Cooper fan. And his music, very obviously influenced by Alice. So in his mind, he was saying, this is going to be perfect. The fans are going to love this. And he said he could not have been more wrong.
Wow.
Because he just wasn't
a fit.
At the time, it wasn't it was a lot more profane and stuff like that. And so you got people who are bringing their kids and going, what is, you know, they weren't the people who he thought they were, I guess, the fans. So, yeah, it's interesting. I always remember that interview because I found myself in similar experiences.
That's very interesting. I mean, you just saying that, I could see that going together, but... I think for classic Alice Cooper fans, that wouldn't be the case. I love Alice.
Yeah, and then, of course, I've seen them together since. Like, I saw Murder Dolls opening for, it was a Gruesome Twosome tour or something with Alice Cooper and Rob Zombie. And that worked, you know, but that, by that point, I mean, half the audience had Murder Dolls or Wednesday 13 or Slipknot shirts. They all knew,
yeah,
you know, or most people knew who the band was. But back then, it was like, that was a, that'd be a limited number of people.
Oh, that's cool. Well, I have taken up an hour of your time, and I appreciate that.
Oh, wow. Well,
man, yeah, that was so good. As always, it's always a pleasure. So hopefully, yeah, hopefully, I'm sure we'll get to do it again, and I appreciate it a lot.
Oh, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure. This is a blast.
Okay, man. Well, you enjoy the rest of your night, and hopefully we'll talk soon again.
Hey, Matt, you too.
Okay, take care.
All right.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye.